Welcome to the Andrew Luck Book Club podcast. Bad news. This isn't Andrew Luck. Worse news. It's Roger Bennett from NBC Sports Men in Blazers podcast. I say I'm honoured to be sitting in for Andrew as he grapples with the NFL season. To be completely candid, I did offer to quarterback the Indianapolis Colts for the season so that he could concentrate on his burgeoning second career as a literary critic. But here I am, filling in to talk about the single thing I love most in the world, apart from America and soccer, which is books. And I'm delighted to say, as much as you're relieved, dear listener, I am delighted to say I'm not alone. I'm here with a remarkable gent, a guy whose writing I've enjoyed greatly over the years, Rich Cohen, a product of the 1980s Chicago suburbs, of which I used to dream longingly about in Liverpool, courtesy of John Hughes' majestic body of work. Rich rode the last dying embers of the magazine industry's golden era. Yes, young listeners, he once had one, pumping out a slew of books in his voicey, personal, ripping yarn style on such diverse topics as Jewish gangsters in Tough Jews, the entertainment industry, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead, with the great Jerry Weintraub, or phenomenally, the 1985 Chicago Bears Super Bowl winning odyssey in Monsters. Go and buy that book right now. His new book, The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse, is out now, available everywhere. It's a beautiful telling of the Cubs story. I'm saying this as a White Sox fan. It is a beautiful telling of the Cubs story from its founding to its curse and subsequent long, barren embrace of futility, telling the tales of the stars of every era and deliciously, once Cohen inserts himself from the 1980s onwards, as he defies his father's desperate plea, "Promise me you'll never become a Cubs fan." Well, Rich did. And the team of Ernie Banks, Ryan Sandberg and Kerry Wood would become core to his identity. An identity that was turned upside down by Theo Epstein and his brilliant diffusing of the curse and construction of a Cubs that win. I'm delighted to have Rich join me to talk about his book, The Cubs and, well, life. Welcome, Mr. Richard Cohen.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Oh, Rich, not as glad as Andrew Luck is to have you, but I love you, mate. You are a man of many passions: music, sports, history. Essentially, you're an American male, writ large. You've written on an eclectic set of topics: the grand flow of history, epic moments in culture, sports. How do you hone in on a subject and say, yes, this is a story that needs to be told by me?
Well, there's two basic rules. One is, if it's something I'd be interested in when I was 15, I know it's a good idea. I never got better than I was when I was 15. So that, you know, Jewish gangsters, 15, yes, absolutely. Rolling Stones, 15, yes. Bears, 85 Bears, 15 for sure. And the Cubs were primal. They were behind everything else. And then also there's the stuff about the new Cubs and Theo Epstein, like you mentioned. But the old stuff is like such great material. It's almost like, I always thought of the Cubs from like the 1880s, 1890s are almost like pirate stories. It's almost like Robert Louis Stevenson, you know, like Long John Silver. I mean, writing about guys like Frank Chance, who got beamed in the head like 23 times and collapsed on the field. And, you know, the player Ray Chapman, who the only player killed during a game hit by Carl May's rising pitch that hit him in the head. And all that stuff to me is so very American, so colorful, and such rich material. It just, I know it's going to be fun to write about.
But why 15? When you say it doesn't get better than 15, I don't want to project. It's a very controversial thing to say. I think 40, possibly, a better taste filter for me personally. But why 15, Rich?
I think because when you're 15, you absolutely know what you like. And, like, now I am 49. I just turned 49.
You look good.
Thank you very much.
You've had a lot of work done.
And I often find myself doing stuff and asking, wait a second, do I like what I'm doing? I really don't like this, and yet here I am doing it, and I wind up doing it anyway. And that never happened when I was 15. When I was 15, I pretty much was doing exactly what I wanted. And when I was listening to exactly
freedom.
What I liked, yeah. And so they broke my heart when I was 15. That was 84. But the Cubs are something I was absolutely passionate about, and that's never, ever gone away.
I just want to insert editorial here, a quick message to 16-year-olds listening. Stay optimistic. Still believe. Don't jack it all in overnight, although there's a lot of truth.
Well, what happens when you're 16 is you get your driver's license. And that's really the beginning of the end of innocence, you know. Then you can go anywhere, and then you wind up doing a lot of stuff you don't want to do. And stuff that can get you in a lot of trouble.
We'll save that one for when we're on the Lyle Alzado book club podcast.
Lyle Alzado died, didn't he?
I'll say, well, I'm still waiting to be invited to do his book podcast. We'll talk about things you do that get you into trouble. But the thing I most enjoy about a Rich Cohen book, and I've read many, many, many of them, is that when you have a personal relationship with a topic, and they are eclectic, the Partisans, the Rolling Stones, the Bears, God, you're like Zelig, your fingerprints on everything that's important in history, but your writing becomes supercharged. The storytelling becomes rollicking. And reading the book, it's no different than sitting in a bar and having a dozen beers with you, and I've done both, and I recommend them both equally. But the personal for you, really.
Yeah, because I would always be like a kid who'd go to the store with somebody else and we'd come back together and I'd have like five stories and they'd say nothing had happened. So I don't know if it's either that things happen to me or I just notice things or something wrong with my brain. But, you know, in this Cubs stuff, it's like going to those Cubs games, going to Wrigley Field when I was a kid, going by myself on the train when I was 12, 13, 14. Stuff happened, you know. And that stuff that happened in the bleachers, getting drunk when you're a little bit older, you know, and doing all that, that was completely interwoven with the experience of the team. What was amazing about the Cubs is they never won. So it was always like, this is great. Could you imagine if there was actually games actually going on?
Games that mattered.
Yeah.
Games that mattered.
It was always like something going on in the distance. That's what a lot of those games were like. And they were often, before 1984, empty. You know, there was nobody there. So you could roam all over the park and sneak up on the catwalks and see Harry Carey, who looked like an animatronic figure that had been injected full of some kind of hormone that brought him to life.
You're telling me he wasn't? You, you know, the way you describe them, it's like describing Culture Club. I used to adore them when they came out with their first single, which I think must have sold all of about 767 copies, and I was seven and I bought one. Listened to a lot of music very early on. And then they came out with Do You Really Want to Hurt Me? And they became number one, and they were on English television, and they're like, number one in the charts, it's Culture Club.
Right.
And I started crying when they came on and sang it. And my mother said, why are you crying? You love Culture Club. And I said, they are no longer my Culture Club. They're now the world's Culture Club. The way you describe the Cubs, and we're going to get to that, it does seem like they were once yours, roaming around an empty park, and now they are very much the world's Chicago Cub. But we've got to talk about your Bears book first, which is a phenomenal piece of writing, a phenomenal piece of reading. Your book, Monsters, in which you track down the greats, the scenes with Jim McMahon, they stay with you, my word. But some of my formative team memories were tied around that Super Bowl winning season. Summer of 1986, I headed out to the Chicago suburbs for the summer right after they'd won the Super Bowl, spent a glorious 3 weeks living in Northbrook, hanging out at the beach at Highland Park. I've still got a pair of green new Trier athletic shorts. That life, that culture, that Molly Ringwald-infused sense of kind of stasis and possibility, you captured all of that so well in Lake Effect.
It's my childhood, you know, and the thing is about the 85 Bears, the whole impetus behind it is, in 1984, the Cubs were great, and they had a song called Men in Blue, and they were really colorful, and they were exciting. And they sang, as sure as there's ivy on the center field wall, the Men in Blue are going to win it all. And they didn't have lights, you know, and the playoff games were during the day, and they were just so great. And then I went to the first playoff game. They blew out San Diego. San Diego seemed like a terrible team. They won the next game handily, and all they had to do was win one out of three games. They went out to San Diego.
What could go wrong now?
And they led, I think, in all those games.
Yep.
And they lost three straight games in a row, and it was crushing and defining thing in my life. At the end, San Diego fans were swinging bears on nooses and chanting 40 more years, 40 more years. Because at that point, it had been since 1945 that they'd been in the World Series. And I was never really the same after that. But what happened is about a year after that, or right then, the Bears, 84 Bears, And then the 85 Bears put together this team that to me was like penicillin for the dead Cubs fan. I felt like the 84 Cubs had killed me. And then the 84 Bears sort of revived me and brought me back to life. And that was a team with, you know, Gary Fencek and Otis Wilson and Dave
Mike Singletary,
Mike Singletary, Dan Hampton, the Danimal.
Willie Gault,
Jim McMahon, Steve McMichael, Walter McKinnon. Payton, Dennis McKinnon.
Jimbo Covert. Kevin Butler.
Yeah, and Kurt Becker, the lineman. Steve Fuller was off the backup who often started because McMahon was hurt all the time. There was a game in 84 they had no quarterbacks, and they had Walter Payton like in an old-fashioned tailback position where he would just be snapped the ball. And when they beat the Redskins that year in the playoffs in 84, I think the only touchdown pass was thrown by Payton.
Yeah. And Maury Buford, my favorite punter of all time.
Yeah. But the thing is, after that 84 thing, it wasn't just that the Bears were great, it was that they were like a revenge fantasy, a Quentin Tarantino movie for demolished Cubs fans. Because not only did they beat the other teams, as Doug Plank told me, who's in 46 defense, his entire career would now be a penalty. They knocked other quarterbacks out, man. That was their mission. They played the Dallas Cowboys, who taunted the Bears my whole life. They beat them, I think it was like 44-0.
Danny White,
who I interviewed, they knocked him out. Otis Wilson knocked him out. Knocked him out cold. He left the game. The backup came in, which was Hogaboom, I think. They knocked him out. Then, unbelievably, Danny White came back, and they knocked him out a second time, which is unbelievable. And I interviewed him, and he said, I interviewed Otis Wilson. He said, well, yeah, I heard ever since that game, Danny White's a terrible driver. And I said, why? He said, because he flinches every time he sees the number 55. Because that was Wilson's jersey number.
Old school NFL humor.
Right.
Not but it comes, aged well. Not aged
no,
well.
No, couldn't do it now.
Time's but not been kind.
But I remember that in a couple years later in 89, I think 89 because I was in college, that was a year the Cubs looked good again, although I'd already been broken. You know, you only get broken once by the Cubs. They looked good again, but I had my guard up. I was in college, and that was a team with Andre Dawson, Mark Grace. Mark Grace, one of the best Cubs ever. And
one of the most handsome men ever.
Oh, he's like Kevin Costner for real in Bull Durham, I think. And that was the year that they had the earthquake during the World Series with Jose Canseco and all that. And the Cubs, they just played terribly. I mean, and there was nothing to say. There's like nothing to say after that series. They got beat by the Giants. And I remember somebody going around the locker room with a microphone, and they went up to Mark Grace, and they said, do you have anything to say? And he said, yeah, go Bears. And that was it. I mean, that's the relation, which is Cubs would kill us, the Bears would bring us back. Right now, it's kind of reversed.
It's so true. It is so true. God, but please, God, the Bears will rise again. And as you say, the Cubs and the Bears, so intertwined. My first ever baseball game was at Old Comiskey. So I fell in love with the White Sox. But that same week, I went to sit in the right field bleachers. The Mets were playing. The Mets of Lenny Dykstra, Gary Carter, and Mookie Wilson. Dwight Gooden was pitching. I think he pitched a full game. And the Cubs of Ryan Sandberg, Sean Dunstan, and Jody Davis, the great Jody Davis, king of the home run swing. They were completely and utterly overwhelmed. But it didn't matter to anyone there. The right field bleachers spent 9 delirious innings just taunting Mookie Wilson. Just Mookie,
right.
Mookie, you suck, Mookie. And I realized I adored it. Winning was not the point.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You bring up a bunch of interesting things. One is it's not so unusual now because starting with Camden Yards, whatever year that was, around 1990, they started making all these baseball parks smaller. But they were used to be big when I was a kid. And you were really far away from the players. You couldn't really taunt them. Comiskey Park is an example. You were so far away from what was going on. But in Wrigley Field, you're right on top of the outfielder. And the big sport, because the Cubs weren't good, would be, could you make the outfielder so angry you'd make him climb the trellis under the ivy to try to get into the bleachers? When I was a kid, I saw Omar Marino, who was a center fielder of the Pittsburgh Pirates, climb the trellis because such nasty things were being said about him and members of his family. And he was sort of driven back just by must have been 10 gallons of beer dumped on his head. And one of the most famous incidents in Wrigley Field, sort of the low point, the nadir of all this, was I think in 1982, a bunch of beer was dumped on Keith Moreland, who's a Cub, and he went into the bleachers, and it would turn into a big brawl where he's fighting the team's own fans. And Lee Elia gave the famous, famous rant, which I can't even repeat because I swear to God, 9/10 of the words were swear words with just, you know, a few connectors and the.
But you trace this history, this delirious Cubs history, back when the Cub Identity, which was framed pretty early, of perpetual joyous losers, defeat, submission, failure. I mean, it goes back to the beginning when the team were known as the Spuds. And you trace the Cubs' history BC, before Cohen, before you started rooting, telling riotous stories. One I loved, the great Mordecai Brown, yeah. The greatest disfigured-handed pitcher of all time.
Well, okay, so something I didn't put in the book, I should say first, because you bring it up, which is the Cubs are originally called the White Stockings. And the reason is baseball was sort of a new sport, and there were these town teams all over America. And they'd play each other, and Chicago thought was a smaller place, and thought it had a great town team. And the Cincinnati businessman put together the first professional sports team in America, where he went and got ringers from all over the countries and built this unbelievable baseball team that went on an epic road trip that won like 88 games in a row. And they came to Chicago, and they played the great town team and beat them, like killed them. And it made Chicago so mad. If you know Chicago, it's like it made him so angry that a bunch of the biggest businessmen in Chicago got together. That's guys like Porter Palmer, all famous names. And they all put up money and they built their own team of ringers. And the next year they played the Cincinnati team in Chicago and beat them. And that's the Cubs. The Cubs were started by a grudge because Cincinnati thinks they're better than us. You know? And that's the energy of the Cubs through the whole thing. The whole team is just riddled through Chicago history, which is they were going to win the pennant early on in baseball and their stadium burned down in the Great Fire. They had to finish their season in Brooklyn wearing borrowed uniforms. And then all the way up to the era you're talking about, which is they were the White Stockings and they dominated baseball. And then the team was dismantled. It's a whole other story. And they were bought by an Irish owner and they were nicknamed the Spuds as kind of, and people were offended by it even then. And the newspaper guy said, you can't call them the Spuds anymore. And they'd already had the headline laid out and they had the space and they thought, what could fit in there? Cubs fit perfectly for Spuds. That's where the name comes from, and the Bears comes from the Cubs because the Bears played in the Cubs stadium, which is Wrigley Field. And last year, everybody's saying the Cubs haven't won since 1908, but nobody was really looking at what that team was, which is that was arguably the greatest baseball team in history. The 1906 Cubs won 116 games, and the season is only 154 games long. And they had this pitcher who you mentioned, Mordecai Brown, who when he was a kid stuck his hand in a wheat thresher and had a bunch of his fingers mangled and chopped off, and he loved baseball, and he worked in a mining company in Indiana, and he would, when he'd want to play third base, and when he'd throw the ball to first, at a wicked curve on it because of his fingers. And basically, there was an old ball player there who saw him and said, wow, if you can get a handle on that, that'll be something. And he became this great pitcher who first played, I think, one season for the Cardinals, went to the Cubs, and had these unbelievable curveballs. And if you look at the way pitchers now hold their hands when they bend one finger back, they're copying Three Finger Brown. They don't even realize it. Somebody taught somebody who taught somebody who taught somebody who is basically trying to duplicate what Three Finger Brown had did. Now, this is something that I love. I love, like, what's the origin, you know, of something, kind of, which is, like, I found out when I wrote my book, Tough Jews, that Arnold Rothstein was supposedly the first gangster that carried his money in a big roll in his front pocket in the 1920s and would snap bills off. And sort of every guy you'd see like at a parking lot pulls out the big roll and snaps them off is imitating Arnold Rothstein.
Everyone, even Mayweather.
Yeah, without realizing
even,
it.
Even Mayweather.
Imitating Arnold Rothstein.
Essentially, everything in life goes back to the threshing machine. And this is a story of a man who pitched in exquisite pain to stay great, but like almost every other Cub story from that period, they all seem to be the same. A player overcoming great hardship, experiencing fleeting glory, fighting drink, becoming alcoholic, dying in a pauper's grave. That seemed to be a repeat Cub experience, only to be reappreciated after their death. You locate a lot of the Cubs' failures, though, to the attribute that was meant to be their one great asset, or we think of it as in the modern period, Wrigley Field. You write, Yankee Stadium, though unsightly, was made beautiful by winning, whereas Wrigley Field, though beautiful, was disfigured by loss.
Yeah. Finally, at some point, I just couldn't handle it anymore. And I'm like, I got to figure out why the Cubs can't win. You know, I think for me, the moment was when the Florida Marlins won the World Series. It existed for like 3 years. They won the World Series. We have won the World Series since 1908. What the hell's going on? It's like the biggest riddle known to man, you know? Like right next to what was before the Big Bang is why the Cubs can't win. And I convinced Harper's Magazine to let me go out on the road with the Cubs and try to figure out why they can't win. Because here you have a team that consists of all players that won everywhere else, that were the best everywhere they played, that are world-class athletes. You put them on the Cubs, they can't win. And ultimately, what the general manager at the time, who was Andy McPhail, who's from the storied baseball family, told me is, look, you're not going to like it, but the reason is Wrigley Field. And basically, the reason is because Wrigley Field is a schizophrenic ballpark. When the wind blows out, it's a hitter's park. You have games like Phillies 27, Cubs 25, or whatever that score was in the 70s. And then when the wind blows in, it's a pitcher's park, and nobody can get the ball out of the park. So you basically have no home field advantage.
And you can't build a team to reflect the ballpark when the ballpark can be.
Right. So when Theo Epstein took over the Red Sox, he could build a team with the big green monster in mind. And same with Yankee Stadium, has a famous short porch where if you have left-handed power hitters, they hit the ball right down the line. It's a short home run. Wrigley Field is sometimes pitched. It's great for pitchers. Sometimes it's awful for pitchers. And if you look at it, the Cubs had been the most winning team in baseball by far, pretty much, before they moved into Wrigley Field. All those great teams, they were not in Wrigley Field. They're in the West Side grounds. And they never won again. In fact, the only team to win in Wrigley Field was the Bears. And there's a great story that I always think is a parable for Cubs fans, which is the Bears are playing in the 30s, I guess, and Bronco Nagurski was the big fullback, and they had a very small end zone. The end zone was cut in half by the brick wall because it's not really big enough for a football field. So they hand Bronco Nagurski the football. He bursts through everybody, head down, runs straight head first into the brick wall. And it sort of knocks silly, and George Halas is nervous because here's his best player. And he says, "You okay, Bronk?" He goes, "Yeah, but that last guy got me a really good lick." And that last guy was Wrigley Field. And I'm like, I know exactly how he feels. He's been doing it to me for my entire life.
I will say 1980s NFL humor does not hold up well, but 1930s NFL humor, still funny. I am fascinated by how curses do work in sports. The perception of curses, which is what a kind of the final third of your book is really about. How cultures of losing are inherited by young players who can be generations away from the original ones who first started to fail. You're thinking the Cubs. I'm always thinking about the England national team. When they pull on that jersey, young, talented players, it's like armor that just drags them under, chainmail. And you write about the supposed Cub curse through your interactions with the great Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub, who said to you, "The curse isn't voodoo. It's just fear. When you've never won and your team has never won, not for decades, it works on you and it gets into your head as you go out there waiting to see how you will fall apart, expecting something to fall apart. And when you look for it, you'll find it."
Yeah, and I really do think it's about kind of a culture, which is kind of makes it a book about any kind of culture. No one believes in a curse. When a new manager comes to Chicago, that's always the first question they'd ask. What do you think about the curse? And they'd always say, "I don't believe in curses," you know. But it's almost like you might not believe in ghosts, but if somebody tells you a house is haunted and at 2 a.m. you hear something funny, you'll get scared, even though you don't believe in ghosts. That was like the players. Like the idea of the curse was passed down generation by generation, and it was in their heads. And when stuff would start to go wrong, they would just collapse. They would hang on to it. When you really saw it is the famous Bartman game where the fan in the playoffs – you know, the Cubs are just 7 outs away, I think, from the World Series. And the ball was hit down the line, and Moisés Salou was going for the ball, and Steve Bartman and reached out for the ball like any fan would do. And Moisés Salou sort of blamed him, and then the team fell apart. And I was watching that game in New York, and I remember looking at it and seeing Dusty Baker, who was a manager, the look on his face, I knew right away what he was thinking. He was thinking, "My God, it's true, there's a curse." And it was like they just collapsed. I mean, that's what was incredible. They had a better team, they had a great pitcher, and they just fell apart, you know? And that's what happened with the 84 Cubs too, which is Leon Durham made this big error and the next hit was a double play ball and it went right by Sandberg, their great Hall of Fame second baseman. The way he writes about that ball is it was almost supernatural. It hit the ground and it picked up speed and it almost ripped my face off and it wouldn't stop rolling, you know? So there's this thing and it's like, how do you defeat it? Because you can acknowledge that there is no metaphysical curse, but there is something going on, and it's a combination of factors. But I think Ernie Banks was right because he thought about it ever since, which is it's kind of fear. And what Theo Epstein did is he said, let's get really young players because people who are young are stupid. and they don't know about history. And also, let's not bring them up one at a time where they can be infected and ruined by this culture. He sort of developed a new team in the minor leagues and brought them all up together. Not all the same day, but within a couple of years, all these guys joined the Cubs. So the result was a new culture, and none of the guys from the old team remained. There was no chain going back to the earlier mentality.
We'll talk about Theo Epstein in a minute. What you're talking about the youth and stupidity, Jurgen Klinsmann always used to say that he loved young players because young players don't know enough to be afraid. And they don't know enough to know they're meant to be afraid. But the book really picks up when another young person is inserted into the narrative. That's really you and your own fandom. You write about the failure of the 84 Cubs, which we've discussed, stunned in the playoffs by the unfancied Padres. And in response, when you'd seen your heroes be revealed to have the clay feet that we all walk with, you ran out of the house, seeing red, seeing jagged lines. You write, "I cried because all at once I realised that life is not fair and that things don't work out and there might be justice in the world, but not for me." And you say, "I became a man in that moment, cynical and experienced. When I went back into the house, I had the same name and clothes and parents, but I wasn't the same person."
Well, it's like every Cubs fan until this current time has gone through it. Everybody had the team that did this to them. And it was like, I think what made being a Cubs fan kind of special, which is we kind of learned early that it isn't fair. And that the best team doesn't win necessarily. I mean, you look at the 69 Cubs, which was the most famous collapse in baseball history, lost to the Mets. They were a much better team. Almost every player on that team was an all-star, and they had like five Hall of Famers on that team, and they fell apart. And it changes you. It forms your – I always said, my father said, don't be a Cubs fan. You'll ruin your life. You'll accept losing as the normal state of human affairs. And he was right. That did happen. But there's something good about it too, which is – I always thought the Cubs fans are the natural Buddhists of the national game because we can take joy in an average August afternoon because for us there is no October. We don't expect it to go anywhere. You know, it's just the park and the game and this exact moment. So it crushed me, but it also formed my sensibility. And it's a little confusing now to live in this world where the Cubs are incredibly competent.
You know, it's so funny. Your father and my approach to parenting is so different. I worked so hard to make sure that my children, all four of them, were Everton fans. It was really important to me. It's probably the only thing that was important to me as a parent because it was the safest way for me to make sure they understood how life really is, that it's harsh and that happiness is but a fleeting emotion.
Right. Well, that's a Cubs fan mentality. My father grew up as a Yankees fan. He's from New York. So he had a completely, you know, ridiculous idea about how things work.
Things really turn out. Boy, God, I'm sure, please God, he was not as disappointed as I've ended up being. Because one of the Cubs stories that didn't make your book, but I want to talk about with you, because I love it. Not what happens, but what it shows. 2005, I've always been obsessed with that of Adam Greenberg, the outfielder, who was called up from the minors. He was hitting 300. I remember watching this game live in his very first at-bat, on his very first big league pitch, full of excitement, anticipation, big dreams. He was drilled squarely in the head by a savage De Los Santos fastball, first pitch he'd ever seen in the big leagues. And he suffered a terrible concussion, dreadful vertigo symptoms that lasted a couple of years. And apart from a charitable Marlins gesture to give him a novelty at-bat in 2012, he never came near the big leagues again. I think about Adam Greenberg a lot. I think about what it must have been like to dream, to toil, to grind, to keep your dream alive, to make that dream real, and then to plummet in the most diabolical of ways. Life is cruel, Rich Kerry.
Yeah, well, that's part of what makes the sport interesting and great and terrible. And, you know, there's a famous story, which is the Cubs, which is the movie The Natural.
Robert Redford.
Right, and in the movie, the woman shoots him before his first day. It's similar in a way. And that's a true story. I mean, that's based on a true story, which is a Chicago Cub player named Eddie Wakis, who fought in the Pacific during World War II. It seemed like action, was not injured in the Pacific, came back, played for the Cubs, was an all-star, and got traded to the Phillies. And this woman had sort of become obsessed with him and had this whole fantasy life that they were going to get married and that they were in love and all this stuff.
It's like me and Stephen Naismith.
It's crazy. She had, her room was full of pictures. Like everything you'd think of like a kind of a horror movie obsession. And when he got traded, she got incredibly mad at him because he had somehow betrayed her. And when the Phillies came back, she found out what room they were staying in. And she got a room in that hotel. And she left him a message and said, come up, I have to say something to you. Now, he shouldn't have been going up to her room at midnight, okay? But he went up and he went in and she was like wearing a nightgown, just like in the movie. And she went and got a gun and she shot him. And she went to an insane asylum and he came back and he played again. But this got to me the thing that's so interesting about the movie The Natural and the story, which is he comes back in the movie and in real life and becomes an all-star. But he's not happy because he can't take any satisfaction in how good he is, but is taunted by the idea about how good he could have been, you know, if he hadn't got unlucky. And I think everybody feels that way. It's like everything goes wrong, but like the rest of your life is what you put together after everything's gone wrong. You're always unlucky. You always get beaned in the head. Something like that always happens to everybody, and it's never what it should be, man. As soon as you get anything, it gets wrecked.
16-year-olds listening, life's amazing. Don't listen to Rich.
But it's good. He builds this great career, but the point is he can't get past the fact that nothing's perfect.
Everybody is unlucky. Everyone deals with failure, apart from one man. And your book is very much a love letter to that one man, Mr. Theo Epstein, the human wonder who ridded the curse. He exorcised the curse. Curse be gone from the Boston Red Sox and then the Chicago Cubs. An amazing life's work. You interview him. And I love the way that he talked about recruiting the entire squad. It was really like interviewing George Peppard about how he put together the A-team after the fact. You know, bringing in David Ross. You talked about the youth that he brings in. But bringing in David Ross, the experienced catcher, because he knew the ingredients that go into winning. And that it wasn't just about talent on the field, but it was about support and great night conversations in the hotel room when the team's slumping, getting over a tough loss, going to dinner together on the road. It all matters. He's got such a grasp of culture.
And it's fascinating. It's like some things you think old baseball guys just did by instinct. He understands it and he's doing it intentionally. You know, if you read like what a great manager like Joe McCarthy, who managed the Yankees and the Cubs, did, I always think of this great story where, you know, this huge moment, whereas in 1969, there was a big error right in the middle of the season that Ernie Banks had destroyed the Cubs, which is Leo Durocher, who was the guy who said nice guys finish last, and he's this really tough, tough guy. He said, screamed in the locker room, and reporters heard him report it, are you kidding? You can't catch that ball. My effing four-year-old kid could catch that ball, make those catches, you know? And it destroyed this player that this was reported. And in the World Series of, I forget what year, but Hack Wilson made a big error. And Joe McCarthy, who was the manager of the Cubs, said, hey, he lost the ball in the sun. He didn't put the sun up there. That's like Joe Madden, you know? And especially with a young team, that's what Theo Epstein sort of seemed to understand, like all the little intangibles that weren't there in the past. And what amazed me is he broke the curse in Boston. And you break one curse, it's like, okay, you know, maybe he got lucky. I mean, not really. Maybe everything fell into place. You break two curses in two different cities. I always think he had to go to Chicago. You know, to win in Boston, win in Tampa, who cares? To win in Boston, win in Chicago, that's the Godfather 1 and the Godfather 2. You know, I don't know what the guy does after this. I mean,
he's apparently going to run U.S. soccer. He's going to be the next president. We're going to win the World Cup, Rich. And you will write the book
about
that.
I don't know if he has the instinctual knowledge of soccer. I mean, the thing is, he played baseball. And most importantly to anybody who grew up in the John Hughes 80s that you're talking about, everybody knows this, he played the Apple II baseball manager's edition where you got to make trades and negotiate deals. And that's what trained him. He grew up on a simulator, basically.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, all he needs is 3 months playing FIFA 18 and he'll be able to lead us to World Cup glory. You're talking about glory. Your experience of last year's World Series against Cleveland, it's a phenomenal piece of writing. You travel to almost every game, watching one of them with Chris Pratt along the way. You suffer into extra innings in Game 7 when Rizzo seals the win. You're in the press box. You've got a press credential. You can go into that locker room. You can see that moment close up, but you're stunned. And you said, I love this. You said, you kept looking at the faces of the Indians who just lost in their dugout, stony faces, and you write, I've always identified less with the winners rather than the losers, and you decide you can't go on the field, you can't go to the after party, and you say, a period of my life had just ended, my childhood seemed much farther away, and you decided to walk back to your hotel room alone.
It was just an intense moment. It really felt like a whole geological era had ended. And I didn't want to go have a big party. The big party, it would just seem silly to me. And I had this weird realization. Like, I got upset at the beginning when it seemed how good they were, which is I realized when you're losing, there's enough for everybody. When you're winning, it's like everybody's fighting for their share. You know, and I know that like a lot of people feel this way. You're happy, but it's also like you said before, you lose ownership of your special thing. You know, Dave Eggers writes about how he felt when REM went from like a small indie band to a band that everybody was dancing to. It's sort of like it's great for them, but you kind of lose your special connection. And the Cubs, when suddenly there became like five celebrities, like it was an LA Lakers game, and you couldn't watch the World Series without seeing Bill Murray, who I love, but Bill Murray, Eddie Vedder, you know, the five people who stand for the Cubs fans. You know, the way I began the Bears book is I wound up on this airplane with Bears fans going down to the Super Bowl. And there were a bunch of guys from, like, the southwest side of Chicago.
A bunch of great Polish guys.
Right. Who were drinking and just, they all got arrested when the plane landed. They threw beer cans at the cockpit.
Most of them were sliding down the aisle during takeoff. They were that drunk. It's an amazing opening to the book.
But it's like, that's the fans. You know, and then when you get to the World Series, a lot of them aren't the fans, or a lot of them are the celebrities that have come along, and that's not the party you want to be at exactly. The party you want to be at is probably going on back in Chicago, probably at the Billy Goat or something.
I often think about my fandom of Everton Football Club. Lovable, hardworking, tenacious, losers. They've recently had a lot of money invested in them. They're going places, maybe not this season, but if this continues, they will change the core of who they are, their DNA. And I read your book and I feel my own emotions, and I wrote down in the margin, don't take away my losing. I won't know what to do without my losing. It's so core to my identity. Have you adjusted to a Cubs that win, Rich?
Not really, because I still feel like it's that moment, it's that team. I was working on this piece of writing, which hopefully will appear soon, where basically the thesis was, we wouldn't be in this mess if Donald Trump had been a Cubs fan. You know, because the whole thing is what losing does for you, that for your character, that's good. All the stuff you're talking about, which is winning is kind of overrated in some way. But he's like, but the Cubs are the world champions and they're in first place in the NL Central. How can you still write this? And I'm like, because it took like 100,000 years for our identity to form. It doesn't just disappear overnight, you know? So I do think that when this group of players leaves the game or leaves the Cubs, which will happen, then we'll have a little bit more sense of just, you know, we're just another baseball team. I mean, there's a sense of that of like, you know, we won and now we're not winning. And just like everything else, like just the Bears, you know, or who are great, but there's nothing religious about following the Bears. There's almost following the Cubs is almost religious. I swear to wear a Cubs hat around the country was to say, my kingdom is not of this world, you know. My championship is in the next life. You know, so sort of to win, it just changes all that. My kingdom is of this world. I'm just like the rest of you guys. I'm here to party, you know. So it is a big change in identity, and I haven't quite grasped it yet.
Talking about parties, your book party, it's going to be at the Billy Goat Tavern.
Yeah.
Famed for its cheeseburgers, the John Belushi sketch. And you're actually going to bring out a billy goat, the origin
right
of the curse that was finally avenged. When that billy goat comes out and you are surrounded, Rich, in your homeland, Chicagoland, the greatest Chicagoland, your folks will be there, your friends will be there from the suburbs, everyone will be there. The Cubs, a Cubs that wins, will be just, everyone will be breathing that air. When you see that goat in the Billy Goat Tavern, how do you expect to feel?
I think I'll feel happy. You know, I mean, I think that the Billy Goat thing is so interesting because that tavern owner, and it's still now his great nephew, I think, cursed the Cubs because they kicked the Billy Goat out of Wrigley Field. And Phil Wrigley, when asked why he kicked him out, said, because your goat smells. And then when the Cubs lost, he said, who smells now? There's been attempts to remove that curse. And the funny thing is, no one ever, of course, took it seriously. It was a joke. And it was PR for the Billy Goat. But over time, it's like the joke that kind of like, maybe it's not a joke. I mean, how else do you explain it? And sort of to be in the Billy Goat Tavern after the Cubs have won the World Series, on the eve of another playoff run, hopefully, with the entire 1986 class of Nutria High School and hopefully some kids from 87 and 88 too. I think that's it. I think that we will all just ascend directly to heaven. There's no need to do anything else. I always said that whatever players win the World Series will go straight to heaven without any need to stop in purgatory, no matter what they've done. I just wish it had happened in a way when I was – if it had happened in 84 when I was 15 or 16, could you imagine? I'd be so well – I'd probably be 5 inches taller. I'd be much better looking. You know, the thing that was supposed to happen had never happened. So this is the ruin of the person I would have been, but I'll take it. It's late, but I'll take it.
You'll take it, Rich Cohen. You will take it. The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse, is the book that we've been talking about by Rich Cohen. Available now, vaguely everywhere. Also, while you're buying it, go and buy Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. It's a remarkable book, a joy to talk about on this podcast. I'm Andrew Luck, and this is my book club podcast. Thank you. Good night, America.